through the minds of both. Those doubts charge the tension of comfortable isolation versus risky intimacy that opens the scene and inflects their choices. Once they dare to converse, however, a deeper instinctive need inspires them to move from chat to confession. As they reveal unpleasant home truths about themselves, intimacy wins out over isolation. That step then ignites yet another value, lost in life versus found in life. Lost versus found becomes the story's core value. As the film's title suggests, Bob and Charlotte, each in their own way, feel lost. When the scene opens, lost versus found sits squarely at the negative. Over the course of the scene, it never touches the positive. Rather, it sinks to the bleakness of beat 15. At the same time, however, the charge of isolation versus intimacy arcs toward the light, and by the capping beat, their relationship touches an immediate and natural closeness. Interior, Park Hyatt Bar, night. Bob sits alone over a drink, talking to the barman.
You got married a couple of times to some nice women. Beautiful women, too. I mean, you and I would be crazy for these women, but there were always rumors. I never liked his acting, so I never gave a damn whether he was straight or not.
Charlotte steps up to the bar. The barman pulls out a stool near Bob.
Thank you. Hi. Thanks.
What can I get you?
I'm not sure.
For relaxing times, make it Suntory time.
I'll have a vodka tonic.
Bob glances at her, impressed.
So, what are you doing here?
Couple of things. Taking a break from my wife, forgetting my son's birthday, and, getting paid $2 million to endorse a whiskey when I could be doing a play somewhere.
Oh.
But the good news is the whiskey works. What are you doing?
My husband's a photographer, so he's working, and I wasn't doing anything, so I came along. And we have some friends who live here.
How long have you been married?
Oh, thank you. 2 years.
25 long ones.
You're probably having a midlife crisis. Did you buy a Porsche yet?
You know, I was thinking about buying a Porsche.
25 years, that's... well, it's impressive.
Well, you figure you sleep one-third of your life. That knocks off 8 years of marriage right there. So you're down to 16 and change, and, you know, you're just a teenager. Like marriage, you can drive it, but you can... There's still the occasional accident.
Yeah.
What do you do?
I'm not sure yet, actually. I just graduated last spring.
And what did you study?
Philosophy.
Well, there's a good buck in that racket.
Yes, well, so far it's pro bono.
Well, I'm sure you'll figure out the angles.
Yeah. I hope your Porsche works out.
Bob nods.
Cheers to that.
Cheers to that. Kampai.
A long pause.
I wish I could sleep.
Me too.
Another long pause. Now I'll take you through the scene, taking note of the arc of its beats, subtext, and value charges. Interior, Park Hyatt Bar, night. Bob sits alone over a drink, talking to the barman. Beat 1.
You got married a couple of times to some nice women. Beautiful women, too. I mean, you and I would be crazy for these women, but there were always rumors. I never liked his acting, so I never gave a damn whether he was straight or not.
Action. Bob trying to impress the barman. Reaction. The barman pretending he's impressed. Intimacy versus isolation is at the negative. Rather than starting with that all too familiar image of a solitary man sitting at a bar, staring into the back of his head, Coppola opens the scene with showbiz chit-chat. A Hollywood star gossiping to a Japanese barman makes Bob's loneliness character-specific and poignant. This first beat hits an amusing note that counterpoints the dark beat that climaxes the scene. Beat 2. Charlotte steps up to the bar. The barman pulls out a stool near Bob.
Thank you. Hi. Thanks.
Action. The barman seating her. Reaction. Charlotte fitting in. Intimacy versus isolation is still negative. When composing a scene, ask this question before committing to any line of dialogue. At this precise moment, what are my character's choices of action? What tactic could she take? Which does she take? Every choice of tactic suggests a quality in the character's nature and determines the words she'll use to carry it out. Once again, dialogue is the outer result of inner action. So what are Charlotte's reactions, choices, and tactics as she enters this all but deserted bar and sees a world-famous movie star sitting on a stool alone? She could be intimidated and leave. She could give him his privacy and take a table, or she could sit within talking distance. As the barman offers her a stool, she makes the boldest choice of the three and joins Bob. Her choice to sit, at the risk of embarrassment, expresses poise. Beat 3.
What can I get you?
I'm not sure.
Action. The barman attending to her. Reaction. Charlotte testing her welcome. Intimacy versus isolation. Still negative. Again, choices. Charlotte could have ordered her favorite drink immediately, but, tensed by the risk she's taking, she hesitates and gives Bob a chance to react. What he does now tells her whether or not she's actually welcome. Beat 4.
For relaxing times, make it Suntory time.
I'll have a vodka tonic.
Bob glances at her, impressed. Action. Bob making her feel at home. Reaction. Charlotte joining in. Reaction. Bob endorsing her choice. Intimacy versus isolation has now moved to the positive. Bob's choice of self-ridicule makes her feel welcome. As she orders a serious drink, he nods in approval, and their sense of intimacy versus isolation moves toward the positive. Two strangers settle in to talk. Bob's self-ridicule announces a character dimension. Actors take their work, even in commercials, seriously, but he chooses to mock himself. This choice of action reveals an inner contradiction between his artist's pride and self-disdain. Beat 5.
So, what are you doing here?
Couple of things. Taking a break from my wife, forgetting my son's birthday, and, getting paid $2 million to endorse a whiskey when I could be doing a play somewhere.
Oh.
Action. Charlotte inviting a conversation. Reaction. Bob confessing to his three chief failures in life. Reaction. Charlotte concealing her shock. The value of lost versus found now is doubly negative. Charlotte opens a door to the unexpected. If you were her, imagine your reaction as you sit next to a world-famous movie star whom you think leads an enviable lifestyle, ask him how he's doing, and, offhandedly, he tells you that his life is misery. The phrase taking a break doesn't tell Charlotte whether Bob blames himself, his wife, or both for his marital problems, but he clearly damns himself for forgetting his son's birthday, and most of all, for corrupting his creative life by choosing money over art. Bob's declaration of failure not only surprises Charlotte, but it crosses a red line, that formal distance we traditionally keep between strangers and ourselves. His trespass puts Charlotte under a bit of pressure. Now that the personal value of lost versus found has entered the conversation, she wonders if she should take a giant step toward intimacy and add her confession to his. She does. Bob's revelation wrenches their chat into cycles of confession. Beat 6.
But the good news is the whiskey works.
Action, Bob soothing her feelings. Reaction, Charlotte sympathizing. Intimacy versus isolation stays at the positive. This beat of mutual empathy takes them a smidge closer to intimacy. Bob's confession in beat 5 upset her, but he's sensitive enough to see what he's done and regret it. He quickly softens the moment with a joke. She, in return, sees that he's embarrassed, and so she laughs in sympathy to ease his chagrin. Beat 7.
What are you doing?
My husband's a photographer, so he's working, and I wasn't doing anything, so I came along. And we have some friends who live here.
Action. Bob inviting her confession. Reaction. Charlotte confessing to an empty, perhaps troubled personal life. Lost versus found becomes doubly negative. From the moment their eyes met in beat 4, they communicate openly and honestly. Cocktail chat becomes in vino veritas. In beat 5, Bob dared an intimate confession, and now he tempts her to join him. Once again, choices. She could have replied, "Oh, I'm having a wonderful time. My husband's on a photo shoot, and I'm enjoying some old friends." Instead, her passive, tepid phrases imply the unflattering truth of her married life. Bob reads her troubled subtext. Beat 8.
How long have you been married?
Oh, thank you. 2 years.
25 long ones.
Action. Bob readying his pass. Reaction. Charlotte preparing to take it. Reaction. Bob making his pass. Intimacy versus isolation is now at the negative, decidedly so. Charlotte has just confessed that her married life is unfulfilling, so Bob cannot resist making a pass at this beautiful young woman by complaining about his unfulfilled married life. Note how Coppola has the older man make his move. He reacts to his own action. He asks Charlotte how long she's been married, knowing that whatever number she might name, he can top it with a quarter century of dissatisfaction. Note also Charlotte's choice. As he lights her cigarette, she sees the past coming and could have deflected it by answering, "Two wonderful years," or more aggressively with a question of her own, "Why do you ask?" Instead, she lets it skate. But, make no mistake, this is a sexual proposition. How serious is hard to say. Bob could be doing it out of masculine ritual, but when a middle-aged guy laments his lengthy, less-than-happy marriage to a young woman at a bar, he's hoping for more than sympathy. Bob's pass could push Charlotte away, but instead, she moves closer. Beat 9.
You're probably having a midlife crisis. Did you buy a Porsche yet?
You know, I was thinking about buying a Porsche.
Action. Charlotte foiling his pass. Reaction. Bob complimenting her wit. Intimacy versus isolation moves back to the positive. Charlotte knows his pass is half-hearted at best, and so she teases him about his age in order to say no with a touch of kindness. He graciously acknowledges her wit. Beat 10.
25 years, that's... well, it's impressive.
Well, you figure you sleep one-third of your life. That knocks off 8 years of marriage right there. So you're down to 16 and change, and, you know, you're just a teenager. Like marriage, you can drive it, but you can... There's still the occasional accident.
Yeah.
Action. Charlotte offering a silver lining. Reaction. Bob confessing his rocky marriage. Reaction. Charlotte complimenting his wit. Lost versus found in life moves again to the negative. From previous scenes, we know Charlotte has doubts about her husband and her future. When she tries to compliment Bob's marriage, he reminds her of a reality she knows from her own life. Relationships rarely live up to our dreams. Bob softens that harsh truth with a depth comparison of marriage to teen driving, but his cynical answer offers no hope. Nevertheless, Charlotte laughs to compliment his insight. Note that beats 4, 5, 8, and 10 play in 3 steps rather than the conventional 2. Normally, a new action immediately follows an action-reaction. Instead, these beats run action, reaction, reaction. When a reaction triggers yet another reaction, it often signals a deeper connection between the characters, a greater sense of intimacy. As Oscar-winning screenwriter Philip Yordan put it, "Do not drown your script with endless dialogue and long speeches." Every question does not call for a response. Whenever you can express an emotion with a silent gesture, do so. Once you pose the question, permit it to linger before you get a reply. Or better yet, perhaps the character cannot reply. He or she has no answer. This permits the unspoken response to hang in midair. Beat 11.
What do you do?
I'm not sure yet, actually. I just graduated last spring.
And what did you study?
Philosophy.
Well, there's a good buck in that racket.
Yes, well, so far it's pro bono.
Action. Bob inviting her personal story. Reaction. Charlotte confessing to an unpromising future. Lost versus found in life. Moves even further to the negative. Having made his second confession in beat 10, Bob draws Charlotte out again, and she confesses that, like her personal life, her professional life is adrift. Beat 12.
Well, I'm sure you'll figure out the angles.
Yeah.
Action. Bob offering false hope. Reaction. Charlotte laughing it off. Intimacy versus isolation is at the positive, but lost versus found, negative. The world-weary Bob offers hope encrusted with irony. Charlotte's laugh lets him know she gets it, and then she needles him with... Beat 13.
I hope your Porsche works out.
Bob nods. Action. Charlotte also offering bogus hope. Reaction, Bob signaling that he too gets it. Intimacy versus isolation is now doubly positive. They're moving closer together. But lost or found in life, again, is at the negative. They both get it. Unhappy as they are, they won't lie to themselves. Sharing this tough truth draws them closer yet. Beat 14.
Cheers to that.
Cheers to that. Kanpai.
Action. Charlotte celebrating their victory over self-deception. Reaction. Bob joining her celebration. Intimacy versus isolation is now triply positive. This upbeat gesture prepares for the downbeat turning point that caps the scene. Beat 15. A long pause.
I wish I could sleep.
Me too.
Another long pause. Action. Charlotte confessing she feels lost within herself. Reaction, Bob confessing that he too feels lost. Lost versus found in life is at the triply negative, but intimacy versus isolation is extremely positive. These two have connected. The lines, I wish I could sleep, and me too, intimate a subtext of suffering as moving as any I can remember. Sleep restores sanity. Without it, existence becomes a mad ticking clock. When you toss and turn, unstoppable racing thoughts send worries and fears swirling and churning through the mind. Charlotte and Bob cannot sleep. Why not? Jet lag, racing thoughts. In my reading of the subtext, their sleeplessness has a deeper cause. As their confessions reveal, they feel cast off from their marriages, adrift in their working lives, at sea within themselves. A hollow place has opened up inside both that neither family nor work can fill. Charlotte and Bob have lost their purpose in life. Character and dialogue. As the film's title suggests, the co-protagonists cannot translate their emptiness into fullness. They cannot imagine their future. They cannot interpret life's absurdity into meaning. In more romantic times, Charlotte and Bob would have been known as lost souls. Notice how Coppola's aesthetic avoids verbal combat and uses casual, offhanded behavior to imply private battles waged behind a smile. She then squeezes vast content into the fewest, simplest monosyllables. Well, I'm sure you'll figure out the angles, and yeah, I hope your Porsche works out. How does she do it? First, backstory. Like the scene from The Museum of Innocence, Coppola could have her characters narrate past conflicts vividly and explicitly. Instead, she keeps the dramas off-screen and implicit. Bob and Charlotte narrate three stories apiece: marriage, career, and private self. They end each storyline in a loss and do it with superb economy of language. Bob, taking a break from my wife, endorsing a whiskey when I could be doing a play. Charlotte, he's working and I wasn't doing anything. They tell each unhappy tale with a charm, wit, and self-mockery that guides us around their world-weary facades to their ongoing inner conflicts. Second, the pause for subtext. Notice how Bob and Charlotte enter sentences on glides such as, well, yeah, and yes, putting a thought-filled mini-pause before most everything they say. The actors also space their words with vocalized moments of reflection such as, oh, and ah, and plus non-vocalized reactions of laughter, nods, glances, pauses with eye contact, and pauses staring into space. These hesitations, short and long, halt the words coming out of the character and invite the audience inside. A mini-pause opens space for thought. Third, naturalistic characterizations. In many of his lines, Bob Harris, a world-famous action actor, sounds in character. Phrases such as, "I never gave a damn whether he was straight or not," "figure out the angles," "a good buck in that racket," and "the whiskey works" could have been said by any of the tough guy characters he plays. Now they infuse his personality. Charlotte's vocabulary, in sharp contrast to Bob's, consists of passive verbs and generalized nouns, absent a single adjective, adverb, or superlative that might add color. "I hope," "I wish I could," "I'm not sure," said twice. Her tone is pleasant, but her vocabulary reflects her achromatic, motionless life. Value progression and dialogue. Once we separate the activity of talk from the actions the characters take, the shape of the scene shines through. As escalating value charges progress the dialogue from the first beat to the last. Coppola designed her scene as a downward spiral that builds its negative power three times over. She progresses it through a series of tumbling confessions that take loss from bad to worse to worst. First, Bob confesses that as a husband and a father, he's a fraud, faking his way through his personal life. Bad. Charlotte confesses that she's just tagging along after a husband who loves his work more than her. Bad. Bob confesses that he's a sellout. He should be working as a serious actor. Instead, he's pushing booze. Worse. Charlotte admits that she has no career or even plans for one, and so her life outside of her marriage has no direction, no purpose, worse. Then the last beat takes them to the basement. They each confess that they cannot sleep. The worst. By building the scene around confessions, Coppola peels away the characters' personae so they can see each other for who they are. These lost souls confess to expose themselves, to be seen. Why do these confessions feel progressive and not random? To begin with, Bob and Charlotte live parallel lives. Both have failed in all of life's arenas. Coppola then composes their confessions so that they alternate in descending order. Which is worse? A personal loss in your private relationships, or a professional loss in your working life? Professional failure. Why? Because failed relationships are a mutual loss. Neither person is entirely blameless, nor entirely at fault. When a relationship fails, you can lighten your load of guilt by heaping it on your partner. When you lose in your chosen career, however, you know the fault is yours alone. We make excuses and blame the system or bad luck. But in our heart of hearts, we know that if we lose in our calling, it will be due to our lack of discipline, talent, knowledge, judgment, or hard work, the usual gaps that spell professional disaster. But still, is a professional failure always worse than a relationship failure? Does losing a job mean more than breaking up a marriage? The key to the bar scene is a build toward a loss of identity. So the question is not one of getting or losing a job, it's one of gaining or losing your identity. If, for example, a woman were married and had a job clerking at Walmart, then a loss of relationship may prove worse than being fired, because the woman's likely source of identity comes more from marriage than a job. But neither of this film's characters identifies with marital relationship. Bob and Charlotte find their identities in themselves as artists. Therefore, for Bob and Charlotte, a professional failure is far worse than relationship failure. Charlotte has made no effort to even name her ambition, let alone build a career. Later in the film, she hints at wanting to be a writer, but to date, she hasn't written anything. Who but Charlotte is to blame for that? Bob is rich, famous, and in demand, but he chooses to waste his time and talent mugging for a liquor spot. Again, who but Bob is to blame for that? Coppola's next twist of the knife is this. Which is worse, professional failure or loss of self? Loss of self. Why? Because if we wanted to, we could decide that careers, fame, fortune, even creative achievement are fleeting and illusionary. We could escape the public realm, fine, but we have to live somewhere. If we cannot find our place in our personal relationships, if we cannot find self-worth in professional achievement, what's left? We must look inside and find a life of value within our being. The dilemma at the heart of Lost in Translation creates an existential crisis. Bob and Charlotte have no visible reason to be unhappy. They seem well-educated, well-off, well-married, and surrounded by friends. In Bob's case, by a world of fans. No, Bob and Charlotte are not lonely. They are lost. The difference is this. You're lonely when you have something to share, but no one to share it with. You're lost when you have nothing to share, no matter with whom you live. Of course, you can be both lonely and lost, but of the two, lost inflicts the greater pain. Now, listen to the beat-by-beat gerunds of action-reaction with the value charges they cause. Overall, the positive charges of isolation versus intimacy alternate with the negative charges of lost versus found to pace the scene dynamically without repetition. Beat 1, impressing, then pretending. Isolation versus intimacy, negative. Beat 2, seating her, then fitting in, intimacy versus isolation, negative. Beat 3, attending versus testing, intimacy versus isolation, negative. Beat 4, welcoming, then joining, then endorsing, intimacy versus isolation, positive. Beat 5, inviting, then confessing, then concealing, lost versus found in life, doubly negative. Beat 6, soothing, then sympathizing, intimacy versus isolation, positive. Beat 7, inviting, then confessing, lost versus found in life, negative. Beat 8, readying, then preparing, then making a pass, intimacy versus isolation, doubly negative. Beat 9, foiling, then complimenting, intimacy versus isolation, positive. Beat 10, offering hope, then confessing, then complimenting, lost versus found in life, doubly negative. Beat 11, inviting, then confessing, lost versus found, doubly negative. Beat 12, offering false hope, then laughing it off, intimacy versus isolation, positive, lost versus found in life, negative. Beat 13, offering false hope, then shrugging it off, intimacy versus isolation, doubly positive, lost versus found in life, doubly negative. Beat 14, celebrating, then celebrating, intimacy versus isolation, triply positive. Beat 15, confessing, than confessing lost versus found in life, triply negative, but intimacy versus isolation, quadruply positive. The personal revelations of losses in beats 5, 7, 10, 11, 12, and 13 continuously top each other in terms of damage to their lives. In beats 10 through 12, the characters' confessions become all the more honest and all the more sad. When Bob and Charlotte toast the wreckage in beats 13 and 14, their newly found intimacy lifts the mood for an instant, but it turns sharply into the powerful irony of beat 15. In the pause that follows their third and most painful confession, "I wish I could sleep, me too," each subtly recognizes a kindred spirit. Their immediate desire is realized in beat 15 as their lives shift from isolation, negative, to intimacy, quadruply positive. With irony, of course, they can't sleep, doubly negative, but they can talk, doubly positive, their lost souls, triply negative, who connect with a mirror soul, quadruply positive. When you survey the gerunds that name their actions, notice how Charlotte and Bob mirror each other. When two people sit at a bar, unconsciously imitating each other's posture and gestures, then echo each other's subtextual actions, they connect with an intimacy they themselves may not realize. The scene climaxes on an overall positive irony and a glimmer of hope. This quiet but surprisingly dynamic scene arcs from easy rapport to bleak loss to the possibility of love. The last beat hooks strong suspense for the rest of the film. Now that Bob and Charlotte have joined forces, will they grow into lives found? Chapter 19, Mastering the Craft. Listen. To master the technique of saying little but expressing much, first train your eye to see into the depths of the unsaid and the unsalable inside the people around you, then train your ear to hear the said. William Goldman, perhaps the finest writer of dialogue in film history, has often been complimented for having the best ear in Hollywood. If you think about it, however, the expression, an ear for dialogue, seems odd. The phrase conveys an image of a writer with repertorial or stenographic gifts riding on buses and listening to the people around him talking and then writing down what they say quickly and accurately. Well, I know William Goldman, and it's been a long time since he got around New York on buses. But wherever Goldman finds himself, he listens in a writer's way, in depth, so he hears far more than words said. Listen to life. From infanthood on, the future writer actively listens to real-world voices, their rhythms, tones, and jargons. No matter where you are, now and then, eavesdrop on people. Take mental notes or jot down interesting turns of phrase and what they imply. Talking is doing. So like William Goldman, listen to people on two levels, text versus subtext, what they say versus what they do. Listen to their word choices and grammar, to the way they shape talk. Listen to the way people use words, not to reveal, but to conceal their actions. When you sense the unspoken, you discover the subtle tactics people take. Listen deeper yet to the unsayable, to the drives and desires that move beneath awareness and motivate actions. Listen for strategy, for talk as a social ploy, Listen to the way one person uses words to cause another person to react in a way that furthers the speaker's desires. When you put your ear to the wall of society, you soon learn that although dialogue is more economical than talk, it's talk that builds your vocabulary. Our internet-driven world forges marvelous new words by the minute. Words like tweet, hashtag, selfie, and narcissistic, a stick to lengthen your selfie reach, are inspired by technology. But compound puns like man-spreading, splaying your legs to keep other people from sitting next to you on the bus, lumbersexual, a fashionably rugged guy, budtender, a server in a pot shop, and linguisticky, a difficult word, are born out of the natural love of talk. Listen for such words around you, or make them up yourself, and then put them to work in your storytelling. Second, read the good and rewrite the bad. Working writers spend much of their non-writing time nose deep in a book. They read novels and plays, screen and television scripts. They watch and listen to dialogue performed on stage and on screen, big and small. They develop an ear for dialogue as a byproduct of all the stories they've read and seen, colored by all the living talk that's passed through their days. Quentin Tarantino's dialogue strikes a brilliant balance between a natural sound and high expressivity. No one, in reality, has ever spoken the way Tarantino's characters talk, but audiences believe the patter as if it were recorded off the street. The imagistic dialogue of Tennessee Williams flows like wine from a decanter. No one can match the novelist Elmore Leonard for creating high-styled repartee between low-life characters. The dialogue of these renowned writers fits the ear like everyday talk, yet at the same time expresses authentic characters with unique voices. If, on the other hand, you find yourself reading a badly written script or book, don't dismiss the writer and toss his pages aside. Go back and rewrite him. Scratch out his words and insert your own. Rewriting bad dialogue is the fastest, most efficient way I know to train your talents. Write in character. Scenes can be imagined from two possible angles, outside in or inside out. When an author writes from outside in, she sits as if in an audience of one, 10th row center of her character's lives, observing her own imagination at work, watching scenes, overhearing dialogue. Given the free rein to improvise, this technique can generate unlimited variations on every possible event. The writer sorts through these choices, tests them by trial and error until she finds an ideal sequence of beats that shapes her scene to and around its turning point. This objective method, open-minded and elastic as it is, risks superficiality. If the writer always stays on the outside, always imagines her characters over there, her perceptions may shallow out and lose touch with the emotional currents that run through her characters' inner lives, driving them to action, and then from action to talk. As a result, her dialogue will fall victim to the many flaws of content and form. For this reason, a writer also works from the inside out. She places herself at the center of her character's being, that irreducible core of humanity that answers to the name me. From this inner angle, she sees life through her character's eyes. She experiences her imaginary events. In other words, the writer is the character's first actor. Writers are improvisationalists who enter all their characters, man, woman, child, beast, to shape them from the inside out. She becomes her character, alive in the now, struggling to get what she wants, emotions and urges surging, taking action after action against the forces that thwart her desires. She feels what her character feels, her pulse pounding apace with her character's heart. This subjective method of creating dialogue I call writing in character. To write in character, use the legendary acting coach Konstantin Stanislavski's concept of the magic if. Do not ask, if my character were in this situation, what would my character do? Because that puts you outside the role looking in. Do not ask, if I were in this situation, what would I do? Because you are not the character. What you might feel, do, or say in any situation may have little or nothing to do with your character's behaviors. Instead, ask, if I were my character in this situation, what would I do? Create out of your own being, but not as yourself, as your characters. In fact, when we look into the background of famous playwrights, from Aristophanes to Shakespeare to Molière to Harold Pinter, we discover they all began as actors. Acting, even for prose writers, may be the best preparation for the writing of dialogue. In her biography of her father, Mamie Dickens describes watching her father, Charles Dickens, at work.
I was lying on the sofa, endeavoring to keep perfectly quiet, while my father wrote busily and rapidly at his desk, when he suddenly jumped from his chair and rushed to a mirror which hung near, and in which I could see the reflection of some extraordinary facial contortions which he was making. He returned rapidly to his desk, wrote furiously for a few moments, and then went again to the mirror. The facial pantomime was resumed, and then, turning toward, but evidently not seeing me, he began talking rapidly in a low voice. Ceasing this soon, however, he returned once more to his desk, where he remained silently writing until luncheon time. It was a most curious experience for me, and one of which I did not, until later years, fully appreciate the purport. Then I knew that with his natural intensity he had thrown himself completely into the character that he was creating, and that for the time being he had not only lost sight of his surroundings, but had actually became in action, as in imagination, the creature of his pen.
To encourage your character to speak in a manner true to her nature, do as Dickens did. Act her out. Let her thoughts flood your mind, and then shape her language in all the contours of vocabulary, grammar, syntax, diction, trope, phrasing, phonetics, idiom, and pace. Pay close attention to verbal details and create a one-of-a-kind voice that catches the audience's ear and lasts in its memory. If, after that, you still find yourself mired in clichés, I have another suggestion. Turn your computer off and go take improvisation classes. If you can invent dialogue on your feet in front of a class, you can certainly do it sitting alone at your desk. Once you have created a scene from the inside out, reimagine it from the outside in. To fully develop your craft, alternate imagining scenes from both angles. Lastly, sit back as if you were a first-time reader or audience and let the scene go to work on you. Develop your dialogue skill by crafting words as an inner action that becomes an outer activity. And in those hours when your work flows smoothly from imagination to page, when you sense the rightness of your words, do not pause for analysis. Just keep moving. But If your scenes war with your senses, if confusion stifles creativity, what to do? Ask questions. Key questions. During the crafting of dialogue, doubts naturally stream through the mind. For which sense do I write, the eye or the ear? Too much description may stall into portraiture. Too much dialogue may drone into recitations. How much is too much, too little? Debates over design and purpose. What does this line do for my character? For the beat, the scene, my story. Like Lady Justice, blindfolded and poised with a sword in one hand and a scale in the other, every author weighs the balance of image versus word, of word versus silence in every scene she judges. Creativity isn't learning the right answers, but asking the strongest questions. To take your newfound knowledge of scene and dialogue design into creative practice, I've laid out a list of questions to guide your writing and rewriting into the furthest depths and breadths your talents can reach. Whenever you're stuck, get back on track by asking the questions that follow from each and every character's point of view. Clear answers will not only renew momentum, but also liberate your talent. The answers to the following questions create the subtext that makes powerful dialogue possible. Background desires. What complex of background desires surrounds the character's situation in life and his relationships with other characters? How do the background desires limit and control his choices of action and his use of language? What actions can he not take, or at least not yet? What words can he not use, at least not yet? Objects of desire. What does the character tell himself he wants in order to restore life's balance? Looking into the subtext, does he also have a subconscious desire? If so, how do these two desires contradict each other? Superintention. What need drives the character down his spine of action? Is it conscious only, or does another desire from his subconscious mind oppose him? Is he his own worst enemy? Scene intentions. At this moment, what is the character's scene intention? What does he seem to want? For complex, multidimensional characters, also ask, what does he really want? What is his subconscious scene intention? Is his scene intention a step in his pursuit of his superintention? In other words, does this scene make sense in the light of the overall story arc? Motivation. Why does this character want what he wants? Scene driver. Who drives this scene and makes it happen? Forces of antagonism. What are the sources of conflict in the scene? Do they come from within the character, other characters, the setting? Scene value or values. What value or values are at stake in the character's life in this scene? What is the opening charge of the value or values? The closing charge of value or values. Subtext. Beneath what the character seems to be doing, what is he actually doing? What tactics might the character use to pursue his scene intention? Beats. What specific action does the character take in the subtext of each line? What reactions might these actions cause? On which side of the beat does this line play? Is it an action or a reaction? Progression. How do the beats progress my scene? Do they progressively top each other? Tactics. With these words, said in this way, What specific tactic is the character taking? What effect is he trying to cause? Turning point. How does the scene's value move in a positive versus negative dynamic? Where is the scene's turning point? In what precise beat of behavior does the value change to the final charge? Deep character. How do the choices of action in this scene reveal the truth about my characters? Scene progression. How does this scene progress my story? The next three questions guide the final step. Text. Outwardly, what would my character say in order to get what he wants? What words and phrases might the character use to help him carry out his tactics, actions, and reactions? Exposition. What facts of history, society, and biography does this line contain? Are they dramatized invisibly or narratized explicitly? Do they come in too soon, too late, or at just the right moment? Characterization. Do the characters' verbal styles match their particular personalities, backgrounds, and traits of characterization? Ask and answer these questions on every beat. When in the middle of writing a scene's dialogue, ask and answer these questions again. After you've written the scene, ask and answer these questions for a third time. The best questions create the best answers. Last words. The technique of writing in character may at first seem daunting, but instinctively, you've done this all your life. After every confrontation you've ever had with another person, what have you done? You've rerun the scene through your imagination, recreating it and rewriting it the way it should have gone down. You've put yourself inside your own head and the head of your antagonist, and then imaginatively reinvented the conflict beat by beat. And I'll bet that your rewrites of life are always vivid, always effective. To write dialogue, you essentially do the same thing you do when you rewrite life. To create character-specific dialogue, you need to gather knowledge of human behavior through close observation of people around you and through reading both fiction and nonfiction. On the balance, however, the source of all fine character writing is rooted in self-knowledge. As Anton Chekhov said, "Everything I know about human nature, I learned from me." Ultimately, you find your characters in yourself. You find their words in your imagination. Ask the magic if. If I were this character in these circumstances, what would I do? What would I say? Then listen for the honest answer, for it is always correct. You would do and say the human thing. The more you penetrate the mysteries of your own humanity, the more you're able to understand the humanity of others and the unique ways they express it. As your self-awareness grows, you will discover you can be many people. You can create them, act them, and speak in their voices. Here's looking at you, kid.
This has been a Hachette Audio production of Dialogue, the Art of Verbal Action for Page, Stage, and Screen. Written by Robert McKee. Read by Robert McKee with scenes by David Pitou and Orla Cassidy. Produced and directed by Cheryl Smith. Recorded by Bob Baradeau. Post-production by Danny Meltzer. Dialogue is also available in print and digital formats from 12, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2016 by Robert McKee. Audio production copyright 2016, Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook, without permission, is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook other than for review purposes, please contact permissions at hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.